The first paper is entitled A Photomechanical Method of Preparing Isophotal Contours by Mr. Peter Tattersall and Mr. Ralph Chu of the Toronto Center. The paper will be presented by Mr. Chu. There'll be a small delay while we get the blackboard set up.
Tells me I'm hidden from half my evidence. No. No, okay, well, we won't need it for a few minutes anyways.
There's the blackboard.
Yeah.
If it was only a printed length.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I guess we'll just have to get rid of it.
Would a member of the organizing committee please make available some chalk for the blackboard?
Well, one of the most interesting problems that Peter and I have found is the study of extended objects, especially in the problem of examining these objects to determine their structure and also the distribution of light within them. And the most frequent method of examining any sort of extended object for its structure is by obtaining isophotal contours of the object. Now, most of these methods which are presently used for producing these contours involves the use of fairly sophisticated and quite expensive equipment. And since we couldn't get access to any such equipment, well, we thought that we might as well try to develop a simpler and less expensive method using photographic techniques. And that's what we'd like to describe to you this morning. In 1937, von Hoff suggested a method of obtaining isophotal contours of diffuse objects. And this method had been first developed in about 1914 by Benedictsson Fredholm in an investigation of the solar corona structure. And what we've done is taken this basic method from von Hoff and made a few improvements. At least we hope they are improvements on this method. Now, the photograph of the object is printed on very high contrast paper with varying times of exposure. And each print will define one isophotal contour, which, following von Hoff, is defined as the least traceable impression that shows up on the print. The isophotes which are produced this way can be calibrated by a number of methods which I will not go into at the moment. This is something that we're trying to work on with our method itself, and we're hoping that in the very near future we'll be able to get something on this. When we combine all the copies of these isophotes, then what we'll get is an overall picture of the gross structure of this of whatever extended object we're looking at, and also an idea of what the distribution of light is within this object. And there have been a number of attempts at using this sort of method, notably by von Hoff in 1937, Vollenquist in 1940, and Johnson in 1960. Now, I'll turn over the mic to Peter, and he'll give you an idea of exactly what the theory is behind this method.
Well,
that material. We then can wind up with an amorphous blob, which has very sharply defined outlines. Now, we then take this positive, as it is, then, and we contact print it with another photographic material of the same type, high contrast, to produce a positive and negative pair. So that if you examine them in cross section, let's say this is one of the films, say the positive, and this is another of the films underneath this area, the negative, what you would observe if you examine the cross section is that this would be where one part of the image is, the positive image, and then here, let us say, one has the other part of the image, the negative. Now, in actual practice, the two images are separated slightly by the base material, which is, in general, an S-star base, plastic base. And this is the emulsion. When a light is shone, on this positive-negative pair, if it is shone straight down, of course nothing happens because it strikes here, and then it strikes at this point, and is completely blocked by the dark, so the grains. However, if the light is shone at an angle, the light comes down, at this point it is blocked, at this point also it is blocked. Here, however, it comes through, and then again, here it is blocked. Now, if you have beneath this positive-negative pair, another emulsion, another piece of film. Now when this light, which does manage to come through, strikes the emulsion, it will form a very fine line. Now of course, if you have an object which is round or anyway three-dimensional, when the light shines from just one angle, you only get one side. So what has to be done is it has to be rotated. So we use, in our case, a 78 RPM turntable, which we picked up from a rummage sale. These things are quite cheap. The light source is, say, 125 watt lamp, and the exposures with Kodaly film are approximately 2 minutes. We then obtain a fine line contour, which goes right around the image. It's slightly, as you can see, it's slightly inside the actual position of the true isopode. However, the change is very slight and it's quite negligible. So you may wonder why we're using a high contrast material. And I think I can illustrate that to a slight extent. I'm afraid that our slide material did not include the prepared drawings, which is rather unfortunate. Anyway, if we consider a reasonably low contrast material, we will not obtain a very sharp gradation. We will obtain, in actuality, something of this sort, where we have something like this. When light comes through, here is a stop. Here it is stopped slightly, so that we'll have a slight effect. Here it is not stopped at all. It just comes straight through the face in between, and so it's complete, so to speak. And then that result will be that we have a very broad line, which looks like this. Now, the whole idea of this process is to make this line as thin as possible. And the only way to do that is to make the contrast of the material which makes the positive and negative pair of as high as possible. This is why we use Kodaly film. Kodaly film has a camera of around 9 or 10, which means the contrast is exceedingly high. It's used commercially in such uses as, for example, microfiche. It's a very high contrast, fine grain material, quite slow, but it does the job quite effectively in this purpose. I think that essentially completes the release the method. Ralph can now continue.
Okay. Now, what we're trying to do at the moment is devise some method of calibrating the contours that we get for any particular object. However, we have run into one very serious problem. This codolith does tend to get a lot of pinholes in it. And for one thing, it's very difficult to distinguish very faint magnitude objects with the pinholes, for one thing. And the other thing is that in the example which we will be showing you very shortly, we've used a 103AE plate, and so that puts a peak in the red wavelengths. And the only calibration values we've got to work with at the moment are V values around the yellow. And so we can't really make an accurate determination of the calibrations. Another thing that we've got to contend with is that in some objects that we have tried to do, and especially in the one that will be shown, which is M42, we found that with this method, we seem to go so far down to faint objects that we just plainly ran out of standards to calibrate against. And Peter will be telling you a bit more about that in just a few moments. Now, there is one other way that we have found through our reference search of producing isofolds somewhat like the ones that we're going to show you. And that method involves using what's called the Sabatier effect. And this is a photographic effect which is produced by partially developing an exposed photographic emulsion and then uniformly re-exposing it after a few minutes in the developer, so that what we get is a partial reversal of the image. Now, if we can choose the second exposure properly, then we can get fairly fine isofolds. In fact, from the published literature on that subject, the isofolds which can be obtained by Sabatier effect methods are very, very fine, much finer than what we can get with the codolith. But there is a problem that, for one thing, it's very difficult to get the technique down pat. And we tried it, and we didn't bother to bring the slide along because, we just couldn't get the right exposure down. And it does take an awful lot of film to experiment with in order to get this method down pat. Now, with our method, we figure that if you want to do an object like the Orion Nebula and cover it with about, 10 isofolds or so, that can be done for a cost of about $5 to $10. For the film, the developer, and paper, and so on. But the Sabatier effect is slightly more expensive, $10 to $15, we estimate. And then, of course, we do get this problem of additional expenses from experimentation. But again, we find that there is still a better quality and greater quality in the isofolds, which we will produce by the Sabatier effect. Now, I think that we'll show you the slides right now for the
this first slide you see is taken from a print of the Orion Nebula. The original exposure was made on a 16-inch telescope. Exposure for about 20 minutes on a 103AE plate. Now, I want you to I want you to be paying attention to this area in here, the absorption feature, and also, to some extent, the region around M43. This area in here, as you'll notice, is also a fairly large absorption feature. It actually seems to come in like this on some of the longer exposures which we have made. It seems to reach quite a distance out. There are also some wings off here which unfortunately do not show up in the isofolds which we intend to make. Now, the first isofold was, I wonder if we could just have a bit better focus. Thank you. The first isofold as you can see, has shown up nothing in this region. So there's no nebulosity around here from M43. We instead have just simple star images. The star images, you will note, are also round. This is because of the fact that we have the turntable going around. And this is a standard effect, which is also observed with the Sabatier process, which we mentioned earlier. I think it about finishes this one. We can go to the next one. This is a much finer image. You'll notice that these are more nearly round than before. These star images is here, here, here. This is one of the great difficulties of this method, getting the positive-negative pair in exact register. It is made a great deal easier by the use of a contact frame. Unfortunately, we did not have access to it. However, I think you'll see that now the lines are very fine. This absorption feature is starting to show up. And in fact, the limit of the isophote at the present time in this region is the granulosity of the original 103 AE plate. The plate itself was developed in MWP2, and MWP2 has the advantage of increasing the speed at the expense of the grain. The grain size increases quite greatly. You notice around M43 we have some nebulosity starting to work its way out. This is the next in the series. This absorption feature is still quite visible. You'll notice that this area around here is still in essentially the same position. Around here the nebulosity is increasing greatly. The images again are reasonably round.
Next.
Here you'll note that in this area we have very little in the way of a readable isophote. This is rather a puzzle. It is caused by the fact that the two images were not precisely in register, and so that some of the information contained is wiped out. The lines are starting to get somewhat broader. This may be caused by two effects. For one thing, overexposure of the isophote itself, and for another thing, the fact that the contrast is beginning to decrease in this region. Contrast is one of the limiting factors of the process. Now the nebulosity around here is showing up very finely. You'll notice that the lines again are quite broad and again reasonably limited by the granulosity rather than the contrast. Now here we have almost completely wiped out the nebulosity around there, again caused by the fact that it's not been registered. The absorption feature is beginning to fill in quite nicely. We've lost the region around here. We have wings starting to form off in this direction. Some slight sign of a wing is showing in that area, and not too much around here. This is our last isophote. As you can see, it's quite bad. And the reason is that the contrast in this region is getting very, very low. The lines are quite broad. One way which we could perhaps have improved this would be to make a second positive-negative pair and get another set of line contours around this region here, and then around the outside as well. This has been done by Richter and Hoegner, who use the Sabatier process. They call it a second-order isophote. However, it's not particularly safe to do, because you can't really be certain that this is a true effect. You can't be certain that this is a true isophote. If you go to the next slide, the last slide now, this is actually made from a Xerox copy, I'm afraid, so the quality is not all that it should be. However, you can see that we do have a considerable range going outwards, and I believe it's of the order of 5 magnitudes. The accuracy of this is debatable. However, in this region, in here, say the first 4 isophotes, first 5, I would say the accuracy is quite reasonable. The outer 2 are a little tricky. They perhaps are out by, well, let's say this one could be as much over as, say, over to here or over to here. In fact, if you look carefully, you will see that there is some overlapping in this region here. And that about wraps it up. Well, there we have to rely on the fact that the star images were not moving around, and the fact that we were using an S-star base. The S-star base is dimensionally stable. It doesn't change around too much. If we had used some of the other available code of films, they tend to vary a great deal with both the wet time, the amount of time it's in developer and so forth, and also the temperature, whereas the S-star base is, as I say, very stable. So that just by aligning the star images, we were able to make the opposite.